Okay, so we're at Kolel study part 2, week 7 on the series of Tshuva's response that changed Jewish history. Last week, we began with a discussion of why the issue of Kolel, of having people who are paid to study, why that's a big issue in Jewish history, and indeed even a game-changing force. And we moved into a discussion of the Rambam as he expressed his comments in the both in the commentary to the Mishnah and in his work Mishnah Torah. And actually a question came up last week, and so I brought a source. If you see your sheets right at the top, I bring you the Rambam from the Mora Nebuchadnezzar, because the question was asked, you know, the Rambam does indeed sanction and recognize that the Torah provides for the Kohanim and for the Levium. And the question was, what framework is that? And the point was made that perhaps this is, you know, a form of Kolel in the sense that they're sponsored to sit and learn. They're sponsored to be involved in Torah. So at the time I said I wasn't really sure. Now I agree, because I went home and did the reading, and take a look at source number 1, the comment of the Rambam in the Mora Nevuchim, his Guide of the Perplexed, where he says, Inyan ha-truma v'ha-maser, the matter of truma and maser, the tithes, truma going to the Kohen, maser going to the Levi, kvar be'er si basam, that's already been explained prior to his comment here in the Mora Nevuchim, but he quotes it in brief. The Torah says, ki ein lo chelek v'nachala imach. The Torah says, give him this support, give him the tithes, because he doesn't have a portion with you. Ukvar yadata sibas zeh, and you know why. Why we do the support this way, as opposed to having him own land and have land of his own. Kidei sheyiyeh zeh ha-shevet kulo miyuchad l'avodas Hashem l'yedias ha-Torah. The goal is, that's right, he's going out. Thank you. The goal is that this Shevet, this tribe, the tribe of Levi, should be set aside for Avodas Hashem, service of Hashem, Uliyadiyas HaTorah, and knowledge of Torah. They won't involve themselves in plowing, they won't involve themselves in planting. Rakiel Hashem Levad, they'll only be for God. Kamosha Kasav, as it is written, Yorumish Patechli Yaakov Besarashali Israel, thank you. In the bracha given to the tribe of Levi, they will teach your laws, Hashem's laws, to Yaakov. They will teach the Torah to Israel. They'll serve in the Beis HaMikdash. So it's true. The Rambam absolutely does recognize the idea of funding Shevet Levi via Truma and Maaser in order for them to be involved in Torah. And yet, he doesn't expand from this to others. In other words, the original point that the Rambam made stands, that he doesn't believe in people taking on this role themselves. Apparently, he views this as being governed in a very limited way by what the Torah sanctioned and no further. It's sort of, either you're in the club and you're supported, or you're not in the club. There's no joining it. One cannot convert to kuna, so to speak. That's not an option. We know the jokes about that, right? I want to be a Kohen and all that. We've been there and done that. That's the Rambam's philosophy as he presents it. We saw it at length last week. Then we saw the response of the Tashbates, Roshim ben Tzemach Duran, writing in Barcelona in the 14th century, and telling us that maybe writing in Algeria, I shouldn't say Barcelona, he begins in Mallorca, he flees, he ends up in Algeria. It's not clear to me exactly where he was when he wrote these responsa, and I use the term responsa in quotes, because as we said last week, these aren't responsa. These are his essays on what he believes is an important topic that the world needs to hear his opinion on, and he puts them in his work of responsa. It's a letter to the community at large, and in fact, not one letter, not one responsa, but 7 responsa. So last week, we went through most of his first responsa on the topic, and we saw his approach. Number one, and the main point throughout this first piece, is that the purpose of sponsoring Torah study is to preserve the honor of the teachers of Torah and the students of Torah as well. And he says, I have plenty of precedent for that purpose. So I'm going to review quickly what we said last week. He says, one moment, which I read out of the Tashbates he said about the Rambam. He says the Jewish people are obligated to support with honor their sages and judges. You won't find it on this week's sheets. If you have last week's, you'll find it there. To support their sages and judges whose livelihoods are their Torah, so that they will not need to cease their heavenly work for the sake of Malacha. They will not be disgraced before Amei Haaretz. That's the goal. That's the main goal. Now, there was a part there that we did not finish, a pretty significant chunk actually from last week that we didn't finish reading at that point. Show of hands, how many people actually have last week's sheet with them? Perchance. No. Got one. The truth is that many of you actually left it with me, and thank you for entrusting me with it, and it's safe in my house. So that's going to be a little bit of a problem in terms of reading along. And I didn't reproduce it in this week's sheets because this week's sheets are long enough. So what I'm going to do instead is summarize what I had translated in last week's sheet, and then you can either get the sheet online if you look at the audio recording of this at torontotorah.com or yutorah.com. I add the sheets there on the website so you can actually pull the sheets from there. Or if you want, email me, and I'll be glad to email you the sheets from last week, and you can follow up that way. But I'm going to summarize the piece that the Tashbates presented, and then we'll proceed from there. The Tashbates first mentioned the Kohen and the Levi. He talked about the role of the Kohen and the Levi, and how the Kohen is supported, and the idea that the Kohen Gadol, in particular, is supposed to be supported by others and elevated and treated with honor by others. And then he continued with the story of Ilfa and Rabbi Yochanan. In order to show that there is a historic Jewish practice of supporting the leader. The story of Ilfa and Rabbi Yochanan is itself fascinating, with much to say about our approach to Torah and our approach to earning a living. The story is that Ilfa and Rabbi Yochanan are having trouble surviving when they're in yeshiva. They don't have economic support. And so they go off and say, let's go earn a living. And the two of them are camped under a bridge, and Rabbi Yochanan hears a voice say, you know, these people are leaving Torah behind, and how terrible this is. And he turns to Ilfa and he says, did you hear anything? And Ilfa says, nope, I didn't hear anything. And Rabbi Yochanan understands that it's a message that's meant for him. And he goes back to yeshiva, where he becomes the leader, the head of the yeshiva. And Rashi comments on the Gemara that, and here I'm quoting from the Tashbates' presentation of Rashi, they would give much to the one who was head of the yeshiva, as is seen regarding the Kohen Gadol, just like they would enrich the Kohen Gadol if he was not already rich, in order that the Kohen Gadol would be someone of stature, so too they would enrich the Rosh Yeshiva. They would make sure that he would be somebody of stature, and so Rabbi Yochanan survives that way. And so, he says, when the leaders of the generation saw Torah scholars who were in tight straits, they appointed the scholars as leaders so that the community would support them. And he brings you another story. Classic story from the Gemara in Horios involving Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua. Also a great story. Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua are traveling on a boat. Likely that means they're headed to Rome. Some sort of negotiation involved. Rabbi Gamliel is the head politically of the Jews. He is the Nasi, descendant of the Davidic line. And Rabbi Yoshua is the Av Beis Din. He's the head of the Beis Din, second in command. So the two of them are headed on a boat. And the trip, the classic three-hour tour, ends up taking a lot more than 3 hours. And Rabbi Gamliel's bread runs out. He has what's called in the Aramaic pita. You may be familiar with this. Pita is simply pot, but in the Aramaic, with a definite object, it becomes pita. So he has his bread, and his bread runs out. Rabbi Yoshua has flour with him instead. Rabbi Gamliel says to Rabbi Yoshua, wow, that was really smart. How did you know to bring flour instead of bringing bread? Trip's not that long a trip. And Rabbi Yoshua explains that he has knowledge of astronomy, and he knows that there are strange stars that emerge. Those who did Daf Yomi saw this recently. It's in Horio, so it's not that long ago, probably about in the last month or so. Rabbi Yoshua says, there are stars that ascend only once every 7 years, every 70 years, and they throw off the navigators, and I was concerned about the navigators being thrown off, and therefore I brought my own supply of flour so that we would manage longer. Maybe it's a comet with a period of 70 years, who knows? But somehow he knows that the navigators might get thrown off, and he brings flour with him, and Rabbi Gamliel is really impressed, but he says to him, you know, if you're that smart, then why'd you get on the boat in the first place? Why'd you come with me, knowing that the navigators could get thrown off? And Rabbi Yoshua gives an interesting response. He says, before you express shock at me, express shock regarding two students of yours, Rabbi Lazar Chisma and Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgida, who are brilliant. They can estimate how many drops of water are in the sea, and yet they don't have bread to eat and clothes to wear. Translation, being smart doesn't mean you're going to survive economically. not to the swift goes the race, lo lakalim hamerots, and dot, dot, dot. So Rabban Gamliel is shocked by this and says, my two students, those two brilliant students, they're not surviving? I didn't know. And he appoints them as leaders, says the Gemara, subtext being, as Tash Bates points out, therefore they gain support. That's the idea. So that the Tashbait seeks to prove that the Rambam is incorrect. We have a record of supporting people in their Torah study. And he goes on with other references which talk about not wanting to have our leaders be involved in menial labor. He points out, the Gemara in Kiddushin says that when one is appointed as a leader, he's not allowed to engage in manual labor in front of the community. It's considered disgraceful to the community. He goes further, quoting the Gemara that says that the community is obligated to support people who learn Torah, even if they're not the heads of the yeshivot. He quotes the Gemara in Shabbos, he quotes another Gemara in Yoma to that effect. He talks also about something called a shipura. Shipura sounds like what? Shipur is an Aramaic word, but what word in Hebrew does it sound like? Good. Simpler. Shofar. Shofar. The Shipura, according to his understanding of the Gemara, was a box in the shape of a shofar. Why would you structure a box to look like a shofar, meaning narrow on top and wider on the bottom? What? Right, it's a money collection box. That's the idea. That way people can put in and they can't take out. So he describes, for those who have the sheet, we're getting towards the end there. The box is set up, according to the Gemara in Gittin, in the house of the yeshiva, and the idea is that it's used to collect funds to distribute to the students. So he says, you see that people were indeed collecting money to support the students of the yeshiva. And he says, you find that in the period of the Gaonim as well, between the Gemara's time and the time of Rambam and Tashbates, the practice continues. He says the following, we have found that in the days of the Gaonim, they had a collection box designated for the yeshivot, and they sent it to all communities to provide a fixed amount for the heads of the yeshivot and their students. We found recorded in the Sidur of Rav Amram Gaon, the following inscription. Remember that Rav Amram Gaon's Sidur, which survives in some form today. It's not clear that it's the original. But we have this Sidur attributed to Rav Amram Gaon. So he says we find an inscription there. Ravna Yaakov, Ben Ravna Yitzchak, sent us 20 gold coins, which you sent to the yeshiva. 5 are ours, meaning for me. 15 went to the yeshiva's box. We have instructed and blessed you with enduring blessings for you and your children and your children's children, right? You make your donation to the yeshiva, and the yeshiva gives you a bracha. That's the idea. So he says, that's from the period of the Gaonim. Clearly the practice is going on, and then he discusses a little bit about why the head of the yeshiva gets 5 and everybody else gets 15. Should it have been 10 and 10? That's its own discussion. And then he says, move forward in history to Rabbi Yehuda al-Bergaloni, is the way he writes it. Some had it as al-Barceloni. He lives in Spain in the 11th century. Who is quoted in the work of law called the Tur, saying, in most places, the practice is to prepare a box for the Beit Din, for the local court, to provide food, and to support them annually. They collect it in the start of the year or its end. There is no issue of bribery or payment. It's not like you're paying off the Beit Din, and now you have to worry that they're going to be biased. For all Israel are obligated to support their judges and sages. This is not some special treat. There will be no bias involved. The community is supporting them by contributing to this box. Okay, so that was the Tashbates in his first salvo. The Tashbates then moves through a sequence of comments meant to build his case. In his next tshuva, his next responsum, he talks about the rabbinic exemption from communal taxes, which the Rambam acknowledged. The Rambam felt that exemption from certain communal taxes is not the same thing as requiring the community to support them. It's sort of a negative. We won't have you do certain things because you're helping the community in other ways and you don't have the means to help them in this way. That's not the same thing as proactively giving them funds. So that would be the Rambam's response. But that's what the Tashbates spells out. Then, in his next section, he has a particularly fascinating discussion, which is just beyond the scope of what we're doing now. And that's where he talks about whether the Talmid Chacham is even entitled to turn down favors from the community. This Torah scholar, Talmid Chacham is a term I'm using interchangeably with Torah scholar, which is really inappropriate, by the way. Talmid Chacham doesn't mean Torah scholar. What does Talmid Chacham mean? Sorry? I could hear that translation, but it's not. It's Talmid of a Chacham. Meaning, Talmid Chacham means a student of scholars. It's actually a student. It doesn't necessarily say anything about the level he has achieved. Nonetheless, Talmid Chacham sometimes is used to mean scholar, and for our purposes, it's good enough. Going back to the point, though, he discusses whether the Talmid Chacham is even entitled to turn down aid from the community. Maybe he's obligated to accept it. And then he goes on in his next response to talk about the concept of Schar Batala, which we sort of touched on last week. And that is the idea that we can pay them for not taking other jobs. Even if I can't pay them for their Torah, I can pay them not to go into law, not to go into accounting or whatever else, because I want people to hold these positions and they had the opportunity to do something else. Then, in the next response, and he has, again, something that would be very interesting to go into, but also beyond our scope, he says that there is an expectation that the person who is being supported in this way is going to be committed to Torah. He can't be somebody who involves himself in other things. He can't be somebody who has a day job. He can't be somebody who engages in poor conduct. He has to be somebody whose conduct is above and beyond reproach. You can't simply say, okay, I've decided I'm opening a book, now therefore you have to give me support. Then finally, in the part that we are going to do today, he takes on the Rambam. And he says, listen, all of this, everything I've said until now is just up in the air, because everybody's heard the Rambam, everybody knows we paskin like the Rambam, we follow the Rambam on so many different things, he's a Sephardi especially. So what I really need to do is demonstrate that the unimaginable is true. The Rambam is wrong. If you take a look on your sheets now, source number 2, in which I have translated most but not all of this responsum. It's simply too long for us to do the entire thing, but I believe I have presented his essential points. He has 2 major themes. His first theme is the sources are on my side, and his second theme is the philosophy is on my side. So first of all, he says, here are my sources. The Rambam, remember, said, there is no source for this, there is no validation for this, you will find nothing in Torah that supports this. To which Tashbait says, really? He says, after all of this has been explained, after everything I've done in my previous 5 responsa, because remember, this is his 6th in the series, and then the 7th is just a summary one. He says, we still need be concerned for the words of the Rambam to Avot. For his books have fallen into everyone's hands, and they learn error rather than that which is correct. So I don't want people to be misled by the Rambam. But his books have fallen into their hands. It sounds like he's talking about some sinister, you know, work here. If there are words to respond, truth will show us its path, and the merit of the early ones will assist. For it appears that he exaggerated beyond his attributes and labeled all of the Gaonim and sages who preceded him and lived in his day as mistaken. Because he became outraged, he erred to the point where he called them insane, and he quotes from Hosea, the prophet is foolish and the man of spirit is insane. This is a remarkable statement, what the Tashbis just pulled here. It's a slap in the face to the Rambam in a very big way. I'm not expecting people to remember chapter and verse, but do you remember, in the early going, when we talked about martyrdom, we had the Rambam's response to the Jews of Yemen, of Morocco, excuse me, and what he said about that sage who had given the first answer? He used the same phrase that the Tashbetz uses here on the Rambam. Hifriz al Hamida, that he exceeded the measure, exaggerated the measure, same phrase. And that he got angry, and therefore he wrote this. He's throwing the Rambam's words back in his face. Not only that, the Rambam is very big on the idea that people follow what is colloquially termed the golden mean, that you not go too far in one direction or the other. The Rambam says there are only 2 traits on which a Jew should go to extremes. Anyone know what those are? Anger and arrogance. He says you have to go to an extreme to eliminate anger and arrogance. He says everything else, follow the golden mean. It's not good to be too generous. It's not good to be too stingy. It's not good to be too far this way, too far that way. Except you must eliminate arrogance, he says. And you have to eliminate anger. He says sometimes it's necessary to display anger. let's say, in educating a child to stay away from danger, there are times when the child must perceive the parent to be angry in order to show this is absolutely wrong. But he says, let it be external, not internal. You don't feel it inside. Let it be a display for the sake of convincing the child you don't dare do this. Yes?
Can you just clarify? Is the mom bomb directed communal support? Is that what it, that's?
Yes.
He's 100% against.
That's sure what he sounded like, yeah. Yes, you got it. You got it. So that the Tashbates in saying that the Rambam got angry is basically saying to the Rambam, you fell into your own trap. It's a real slap in the face. And then he says, not only that, but the Rambam is on easy street. Who is he to pontificate about accepting support? Even if his mazel aided him, for he was close to the government and honored for his medicine and wisdom in his generation, and he did not require support from the communities, what should sages and scholars who have not reached this do? Right? The Rambam has a cushy job. He's the doctor to the Sultan. He's in good shape. What about everybody else? What about us? Remember the backstory we introduced last week. The Tashbates himself is a physician who loses his ability to support himself, and then it has to be supported by the community. So the Tashbates is speaking from his own experience when he says this. So he says, should they die in famine, or be degraded in their honor, or throw off the yoke of Torah from their necks? This is not the intent of Torah, Mitzvah, and Talmud. He says, that can't be. Unacceptable. Know that when he, the Rambam, wrote, there is nothing in Torah to validate this, I'm in the second paragraph now, he forgot or abandoned the lesson, which he's quoted earlier, the Kohen who is greater than his brethren, elevate him from the property of his brethren, which we talked about last week. And their equation of people of status with the Kohen, as we have already written, he says, I've already told you, this doesn't isn't just the Kohen that has to be elevated, it's generally the leaders who get elevated. Yes?
I'm just wondering about the conflict.
That I have sources on my side, Rambam has sources on his side. It's not that there's a conflict going between yeshivot. I mean, remember, Tashbates is writing significantly later. Yeah.
Would the Rambam have agreed when it comes to Rosh Yeshiva or to the Nasi that the community supports, but maybe saying the average person or just, he's against having people of color who are not in leadership?
The Rambam was pretty clear. He supported nothing like it. He was very clear about it. He said, Hillel is chopping wood. Rabbi Tarfon is upset that he used his honor to save himself from being killed. He could have instead bought the guy off. He doesn't want to see anybody doing this. He's pretty straightforward about it. It's very hard to find some way to make the Rambam work with the sources that the Tashbates cites. He goes on. Source after source after source, paragraph after paragraph. He says, we have found validation for this in the Torah against the words of the Master. And if one will say this is an asmachta, this idea that he supports the Kohen is what we call an asmachta, which means a concept that we link to a biblical verse, but it's not explicit in the Torah. It's really a concept that we're just sort of tying to a biblical passage. He says, I will reply that the prohibition against this practice is also only from the Medrash. Your source for saying that teachers of Torah should teach for free is also from an extra-biblical source. It's not from biblical text either. It's Gemara in Nedarim, he quotes. Moshe says, and God instructed me, and then the Medrash comments on it saying, just as I, Moshe, taught Torah for free, so you shall teach Torah for free. So the whole idea that I should teach Torah and not get paid for it is also asmachta, if you will. It's also rabbinic extrapolation from biblical verses. So don't tell me that my sources aren't authentic. And they also said explicitly, the Gemara in Yoma, that people of a city are required to support a Torah scholar who lives there. They found a drasha, a lesson from the Torah for this, also extrapolated from a verse, as we have noted above. Further, Rabbi Elazar only... I wrote too quickly when I translated that. Rabbi Elazar only found a cure for Ame Haaretz in benefiting Torah scholars with their wealth. Amei Haaretz, unlearned people. He said the only way that they can gain a cure, so to speak, for their situation is if they use their wealth to help scholars by giving them business. Learning this from Psukim, from biblical passages. What greater validation from the Torah would the master expect? He says, Rambam, help me out here. You're telling me there's no validation. I can bring you source after source after source that says there is. So perhaps, he says, maybe there's a compromise. Perhaps the master will say the community is obligated in this, but if they refrain and do not engage in it on their own, then a sage may not demand and request his share verbally, right? We're in the third paragraph now. Maybe you'll tell me that in fact this seems like a likely reading of the Rambam, that what he's really incensed about is people coming to the community and saying, you have to support me. If the community wants to support, let them offer support. You can't send them letters every few months with little calendars and notepads and whatever else in them saying, you know, give me a check. Maybe that. But he says this is not the view of the sages. And it may be challenged from Rabbi Ami, Gemara Nechulin, who took the sack of Inarim first. We read that story last week. A sack of coins are brought to the Beis Medrash, to the study hall, and Rabbi Ami takes some for himself and leaves the rest for the other students. He took it. How could he take it? Further, since the Torah requires this, the Torah says you have to support them. So if the population were to ignore this, why would the sages not instruct them and compel them? Don't you have an obligation to teach people? So teach them what their obligation is. If you believe that they're obligated to support, then tell them that their obligation. He says, regarding rising and honoring a sage, right, this is a separate issue and a separate, it's a show of respect that the Torah requests. The sages were demanding of those who did not fulfill it. If a person didn't do that, the sages insisted on it. As seen in Kiddushin 33a, Rabbi Shimon, the son of Rebbe, was upset at Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Shmuel bar Rabbi Yosi, who did not stand before him. And sages verbally demanded that others stand for them. Abaye said to Rabbi Misharshia and the sages who did not rise before him, am I not your clear mentor, the term in Hebrew, Rabbi Muvhak? The clear mentor. And in the Shildot of Rav Acha of Shamcha, this is a Gaonic source, post-Talmud, pre-Rambam's time, I found language like this. One who does not rise before the sages is forced to show them the honor of Torah. So he says, if we compel them to rise, why don't we compel them to make their contribution? I'm jumping to the next paragraph, paragraph number 4 now. Perhaps the master will say this is different, because there is no expenditure of funds involved. When I say number 4, they're not numbered. It's just the fourth paragraph. There is no expenditure of funds involved, and so there is no desecration of Torah. In other words, maybe you'll tell me, it's one thing to tell people you have to stand. Because telling them to stand doesn't take anything away from them, and more doesn't mean you're being supported by them. One of the Rambam's concerns seems to be that if a Torah scholar is supported by the community, it looks bad. Right? It makes him a servant of theirs. He's on the payroll. So maybe you'll tell me that's the objection. He could tell them to stand up when he walks in the room, because that's about respect for him. He can't tell them to give him money, because then it'll be about disrespect and dishonor. So maybe that's what you'll say. But the expenditure of funds involves desecration of Torah, as Amei Haaretz, the unlearned population, degrade scholars who take money from them. But this is not the way of the Mishnah, which links the matter to a crown and a blade, not the mindset of the Am HaAretz, good or bad. He said, the Mishnah said, don't turn the Torah into a crown for yourself. Don't turn it into a blade with which to dig. It didn't talk about how you're going to be perceived by others. The issue was only not taking Torah to benefit yourself. Further, the master should then have ruled that the prohibition is specifically against taking for oneself, but taking to distribute to other sages, which would not involve desecration, would be permitted, right? If the concern is, I'm going to look like a schnorrer, so I should be allowed to go collect for other Talmidei Chachamim. But the Rambam didn't make any such distinction. All of these have neither root nor branch and are not at all clear, he says. And he goes on. You can see more in the translation that I'm offering you here. But I think I want to go further with it only because we have so much else that we still need to see. Look at his last paragraph that I translated here. He, in the area that I skipped, he talks about various sages who did indeed support themselves. He does mention that. He talks about the story of, he talks about Shimon Fakuli, he talks about the possibility that Shammai might have been a builder, Rabbi Yochanan Asanlar making sandals. And he says, yeah, that was a pious practice of theirs. You know what? Actually, I should go back to it. If you see the ellipsis after the word sandals in the penultimate paragraph, I just wanted to say that. You see the word sandals and then the ellipsis? It's toward the beginning of a line in mind, but I'm working with the Hebrew English. Should be the same, though.
Yeah.
Does everyone have that? It's about the middle of the page?
Middle of the big paragraph.
Does that help? Are we... Yes? There is... No, there's an English copy here. I should just take a look and that will be able to help. Yes, there it is. If you count down from the top, you want to count down about 12 lines, 13 lines. The first word on the line is sandals. Okay? That's what you want. After he's listed a number of sages who worked, he says, but no... that all that they did was as piety. The fact that they worked instead of being supported was a trait of piety. To fulfill biblical verse, when you eat the exhaustion of your hands, it is good for you. They involve themselves in Torah and perform their work. But not all generations are equal. They said, see the difference between earlier and later generations. Earlier generations made their Torah fixed and their work temporary, and both remained in their hands. Later generations made their Torah temporary and their work fixed, right? They had set hours to go to work, and they learned Torah fitting it around it, and neither remained in their hands. They don't make a living, and they don't learn Torah. So his point is that you're trying to compare sages who could successfully work at a job and become Torah giants with people who, frankly, struggle at both. They said in Bracha 32b, the early pious ones waited 1 hour before praying and waited 1 hour, it should say, after they prayed. If they spent 9 hours in prayer, right? We pray three times a day. So assuming it's literally 1 hour before each and 1 hour after each, when were their Torah and work performed? Right? It takes you to pray. You're praying for 9 hours. You're sleeping for some period of time. What's left to the day? Because they were pious, their Torah was protected and their work was blessed. And because their heart was open like the Beis HaMikdash, it was that a huge open heart, it means that they could learn well and learn easily, as seen in Erevin 53a, they could return to their Torah easily even if they had to leave it for their work. Therefore, they worked temporarily, and it was blessed. They also involved... blessed. I sent it in before reviewing. Mistake. They also involved themselves in light work, like stitching, as did Abba Chanan, in order not to be interrupted from their Torah, in order to learn that work, to learn that trade. Now, though, the angel of forgetfulness is common, and our heart is like the hole in a needle. It's hard for us to introduce new things to our brains. We say in Temura that halachot were recorded in writing because, quote, it is a time to act for God, they have nullified your Torah. The written Torah had to become written because people were forgetting what they had learned. One who would involve himself in work would never see blessing in his study. He says, what am I supposed to do? You need people to be supported because otherwise they're never going to succeed. It's as though you told me that the graduate department of physics at the university, the engineering researchers over at U of T, should have a day job. They should flip burgers or whatever they're going to do. And then, you know, for a few hours, they can you know, do a little work in their physics, do a little work in their engineering. He says, that's not going to cut it. In order to be able to do proper research, you need to be devoted to it. Maybe at some point it worked differently in the past, he says, but it doesn't now. Last point, he says, in the last paragraph. As far as what he wrote regarding taking money from people against their will, that we shouldn't do that, he is correct. It is not the way of Torah scholars to be as white geese removing people's cloaks. That's a passage of the Gemara he's borrowing. But there is no concern if they participate willingly. This is one of the ways of the sages, as I have explained. It would even be appropriate to say that compelling them would be obligatory for a Torah scholar in order to guide them in a straight path, as I showed above regarding rising and showing honor. He's willing to give a little bit and say, maybe the compulsion part is the problem. That I'll give the Rambam. But everything else, he believes he has successfully leveled the Rambam on this topic. And from now on, from this day forward, let Torah go forth from Algeria or Mallorca or wherever he is when he writes this. But from this day forward, let the world understand that the Rambam is incorrect and that Torah study should be supported by the community. That's the argument that he gives. He says, the sources are on my side. And he argues the philosophy as well, saying that we need to guide people to support Torah, we need to educate people. Fine. It doesn't work. For all of the erudition displayed by the Tashbetz in this really remarkable collection of sources that he presents, and again, I only translated part of what he has, he's got much more on this. For all the erudition, and for all the fact that he was a recognized giant, he's not some writer in some little town who's taking on the Rambam. Nonetheless, everybody from then forward wrestles with the Rambam, and while they use the sources that the Tashbetz brings to bear, they don't really quote the Tashbetz much. Each one needs to revisit the Rambam anew and confront the fact that the Rambam didn't like this kollel practice. So I brought you some of the approaches that have been used historically to try to deal with this. The first one, from Rabbi Yosef Karo, no less than the author of the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, in his Kesef Mishnah commentary to the Rambam, where the Rambam had opposed kollel in Hilchos Talmud Torah, the laws of Torah study. He says, "Va'achrei hodiya Hashem osanu es kol zos," and following on previous comments, he says, now that God has told us all of the above, all of his previous points, which I didn't bring here, he says, "Efshar lomer," it's possible to say, "Shekavanas Rabbeinu kan hi she'en la'adam lifrog o malacha me'alav k'delis parnes min habrios." He says, maybe what the Rambam is saying is that it's not right for a person to cast off the yoke of malacha, of work, in order to be supported by others in his studies. Rather, he should learn malacha, a trade, some form of work, which will support him. If that suffices, good. If it doesn't suffice, he should take his sustenance from the community, and there is nothing wrong with that. In other words, suggests of Yosef Karo, the Rambam has to differentiate between lechatchila and bidyevet. Lechatchila, what we do initially, and bidyevet, ex post facto, if I'm in this situation and I'm stuck, what I do next. He says the Rambam's counsel is what you're supposed to try to do. Yes, you're supposed to try to have a trade, and then the trade is what you use to support yourself, and you will learn Torah. But not everybody can get a job. So you can't get a job, then you need to go seek help from others. And he says, maybe that's a way that I can walk the line between the Rambam saying, don't take assistance, and the Tashbetz's million sources that say that they took assistance. Maybe the answer is that they couldn't get a job. That's one approach that's been taken. Second approach, along similar lines, but expanded, is from the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Chiel Michal Epstein, who was the Rav in Novardok in the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. A remarkable figure worthy of his own series at some point. Tremendous on many fronts. So look at what he says. He says, even according to the Rambam's words, that is only regarding, that meaning that you shouldn't be supported, is only regarding a person who is healthy and can work in malacha or a trade. He's using malacha. I keep using malacha and not translating it, because sometimes malacha means manual labor, and sometimes it means a job. And it's not quite clear where the differentiation is here. Here, I think it is clear. Here he means malacha as manual labor. He says, that's only regarding a person who is healthy and can work in malacha, manual labor, or a trade, and can support himself. One who is elderly, or ill, or who has no means of support, may benefit from his Torah and have others support him. That's his first point, much like Rabbi Yosef Karo's point. Then he says, also, if the community does not wish, and it does not benefit their honor, for the sage to be involved in malacha or trade, he certainly may receive from the tzibor, from the community, in order to have the means to support his life. There is no greater schar batala than this. Schar batala means payment for not taking other jobs. He says the community might wish to do it. Now, the Tashbetz already showed that the sources indicate that you can even compel the community. But he's stepping back from Tashbetz and saying, maybe I'll grant you that compulsion is wrong, but if the community offers it, then indeed the sage should take it. Mind you, Rambam would oppose this idea, because the Rambam wrote explicitly that he opposes this idea. He said, you're not supposed to take assistance even when it's offered. But he's offering this as a compromise. We don't compel people, but if they want to step forward and support, it's good. Rav Moshe Feinstein dealt with this as well. Rav Moshe Feinstein wrote about this in a couple of places, but here's an excerpt from one responsum. He says, look at the Rambam's wording more carefully. there is an apparent contradiction in that at first he wrote that if one does not perform malacha for his support, then this is the greatest transgression, for he desecrates God's name and degrades the Torah and extinguishes the light of religion. For one cannot benefit from words of Torah in this world, and his benefit is great, and his punishment is great, for he removes his life from the next world. That's the Rambam's first comment. The Rambam is saying it is absolutely prohibited to take support. Rav Moshe Feinstein, writing this response, I might believe, is the 1970s, maybe the early 80s, says, look at what the Rambam wrote next. And then immediately he wrote that it is only a great level, a ma'ala, it's good for one to be supported by the work of his hands. It is the trait of the early pious ones, which seems to say clearly that there is no prohibition involved in receiving aid. It is only not according to the level of the early pious ones, right? The Rambam's second half seems to say it's good to work. Whereas first half said, it's horrible to be supported and against the law. The Rambam is shifting gears. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, maybe there's something in that. We must say that even the Rambam believes that if one knows he will not be able to comprehend well what he learns, if he must also work for several hours for a livelihood, then he may, and he is obligated to, be supported by the gifts of others, and certainly from tzedakah. For there is no one more needy than someone who cannot be supported by his malacha when he studies Torah. It's a very interesting justification. It reminds me of the Tashbetz. Right? His statement is that one could be supported by the gifts of others, one could take tzedakah if, by holding his job, he isn't going to be able to learn Torah. If his job is going to keep him from Torah study. Right? The Tashbetz said, maybe those early authorities who held jobs did so because they could hold a job and still learn Torah. We can't do it. That's the Tashbetz writing. So that's what Rav Moshe Feinstein is quoting as well. He's taking the Tashbetz' idea and saying, maybe that's the explanation. Ah, but you'll tell me that there's degradation of Torah when you're supported by others? No. He says, there is no Kiddush Hashem, sanctification of God's name, and honor of Torah greater than this, when someone degrades himself to receive tzedakah so that he might have the means to learn Torah. He says, you know what? It's degrading to take help from other people. You want to feel like you're independent and you can stand on your own 2 feet. This is not a fun thing to do. The fact that a person is willing to do this in order to study Torah is itself a display of honor for Torah. That's Rav Moshe Feinstein's approach. What we see here, I brought you three, there are many more responses on the topic. What we see is that the Rambam looms large. The Tashbetz is not personally quoted on this, but the sources that he brings are all quoted down the line, and his ideas make it down the line. The idea that you can't compel people, but you can accept help. The idea that someone who can't get a job could be supported while he learns Torah. The idea that someone who would be unable to learn while he's working is entitled to say, "Well, I won't work then, and I'll just be supported." These are all responses, it's ideas that are suggested, which stem from the Tashbetz's comments. You follow? Okay. One last thought, though, very important in terms of the development of halacha. I noticed that they started titling this series out on the bulletin board as History of Halacha, so we'll do a little history of halacha. Very important note from Rav Yosef Karo on this, in source number 6. He says, you know what? After I've presented the possible justifications and explanations of how one could take support, and I said, well, maybe that's the Rambam's view, too, he says, even if that is not the view of our master, even if that's not the Rambam, but rather, it is as his words appear to say in his explanation of the Mishnah, meaning he prohibits everything. Still, we know that when the law is uncertain to you, you should follow the minhag, the custom. We have seen all sages of Israel, from before the time of our master, meaning the Rambam, and afterward, accept payment from the community. Even if we must admit that the law follows our master's words in his explanation of the Mishnah, it is possible that all of the sages of the generations agreed to this practice. Due to, and he quotes the classic line, it is a time to act for God, they have annulled your Torah, which is the phrase we quoted earlier, that the Gemara uses to justify the recording of the oral Torah in writing, the justification being, I know I'm not supposed to write down the spoken Torah. It was meant to be a verbal tradition. But if you keep it spoken, it's going to be forgotten entirely. So we have no choice. He says maybe that's what went on here. It could be the Rambam is right, and the sources are on his side. But I hate to tell you this. If we do that, no one's going to be learning the Rambam any longer. Because no one's going to be able to learn Torah any longer. Because everyone's going to be at their jobs, and there's going to be no one in the R&D department. And all the things that we talked about, all the advantages of the Kollel phenomenon, the idea of people sitting and studying and being supported, having this department for research to deal with new issues, generating teachers for the community, demonstrating values for the next generation, the merit of the Torah study and all that, it's all going to be lost. So we needed it. Without the available support of students and teachers, they could not work in Torah appropriately, and Torah would, God forbid, be forgotten. When support is available, they can involve themselves in study, and Torah will grow and be strengthened. He says, you know what? I can't answer for the Rambam. He says, I made my best attempt, and others are going to make their best attempt in the centuries that follow Rabbi Yosef Karo. But at the end of the day, even if this isn't what the Rambam meant, this is what we do. And even if the Rambam is right and all of us are wrong, it's still what we do. Because at the end of the day, this is what is necessary for the preservation of Torah down the line. Yes?
People still seem to be concerned about what the Rambam is saying, because I've heard it said that teachers are paid for their schar batala, for their preparation time, or they're not able to do other work, and they're not getting paid specifically dafka for their teaching of Torah.
Right. So that's
so it seems
right.
To be a concern for what the Rambam is saying.
Right. So it's funny because the Tashbates threw that in, and it was sort of a red herring, I think. Meaning the Rambam never prohibited that as part of this discussion. There really are two separate discussions. One discussion is whether you're allowed to be paid to teach Torah, and the Tashbates quoted the source, the Gemara, that says you're not supposed to be paid to teach Torah. And then separately, the discussion about being paid to study. The Rambam didn't mix the two. The Tashbates was going to mix the two. It is entirely possible to say that I don't agree that you can be supported to study. However, you could take payment for schar batala. It is entirely possible to say that you can be supported while you're studying, and yet your payment for teaching has to be schar batala. It's not inconsistent. So the Tashbates has muddied the water a little bit by bringing that in, but I would actually contend you can follow the Tashbates on this and say that support while studying is a positive thing, and yet say that teachers can't be paid to teach Torah. They can only be paid for not taking another job. Yeah. So that's this topic. Clearly there's a lot more we could have done with this. I wanted to ask you, we have two classes left in the series. So there are a few different ways we could go with it. David, if you can cut the video at this point. Well, you know, I will cut the video here, but I'll let him know that he can cut it himself. Because there's no point for recording this piece.